Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Silver Indians Live on Wednesday nights. My name's Karen, your host, and tonight we have Gary, and he's going to be taking us through his journey to sobriety. Hi, Gary, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Very welcome. Thank you for coming on. Greatly appreciate it. I wanted to start with you telling everybody a little bit about yourself, and then we just kind of go on into your story from there.
Okay. So my name is Gary. I am a Native American. I am from northern Minnesota, Red Lake. I am from the Red Lake Nation. I currently live in central Minnesota on the Mille Lacs Reservation. I am a solid waste driver, a garbage truck driver for the Mille Lacs Band. And with that, I also rescue dogs and cats when that's possible. But that's me. I have been an addict, been addicted for 45 years. I'm going to share 45 years of my story and try to make it as short as I can. And I have just recently celebrated 4 years of recovery.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
You're welcome. So tell us, if you don't mind, tell us what began everything from the addiction to where you are now.
Okay, so I can start now? You want me to start now?
Yes.
Okay, and again, I thank everybody for listening, for coming on and listening to my story on Silver Indians. I was invited by Pat McCoy, awesome guy. Pat was a mentor to me for a couple of years, and he's just, I love the guy. He's incredible. He's amazing. And so my story starts when I was a young boy. I'm 55 years old. My addiction started when I was 10 years old. But when I was a young boy, I was I don't like to say the word victim, but I was physically abused by my stepfather for a lot of years growing up, and so much so that I feared this man. I feared this man and what he would do to me when I would be punished for certain things. And growing up like that in my household, I had a younger brother and my mom, we were all victims of that. We were all part of that abuse, you know, when I was really, really young. And, you know, as I got older, I learned to just stay clear of this guy. And when I got a little bit older, I started being from a reservation. My family used to like to, on the weekends, I used to like to have, you know, they celebrate, have a good time. And they used to like to have their beer and dance and listen to music. And when I would get together with my cousins and we'd sneak a couple beers once in a while, you know. And so that at that time, that was kind of cool, a cool thing to do. And so I remember the first time we did this, and we grabbed a few beers, and I drank a beer, and I drank another beer. And I remember that feeling that it gave me after I drank that beer, and I just remember how good it felt. And I remember that, you know, I told myself, I want to feel like this all the time. I wish I could feel like this forever. And I did. After that I enjoyed that feeling of being high or being drunk, that I continued to do it as much as I could growing up. Now I'm 10 years old at this time, and I got a couple years, you know, go by, and my mom and them used to have a babysitter that used to come and keep an eye on us when they would go out of town for the weekends or whatever. And she used to do things with me sexually. And while this was going on, you know, she was always telling me that we had to keep that quiet, you know, that we weren't supposed to talk about it or let anyone know, otherwise we'd get in a lot of trouble. Well, I feared that if my stepdad found out, that'd be the end of me. So, yeah, I kept that a secret. That was something that I kept a secret, but it was also something that, you know, as a young child, you get confused by that because what's going on feels good. You know, we all have that about us inside of us that's natural. They say that sex is the second powerful drive in the human being. So it's God-given. It's natural. So I got confused by that, you know, growing up and being, making that be a secret and being ashamed of that, being ashamed of something that felt good, that felt right. But I explained to you why I had to keep that a secret. And so as I got a little bit older, you know, continued to drink, continued to get high with whatever I could. And at that time, there wasn't the drugs that there are today. There's a lot of, you know, smoking weed. There's a lot of taking pills whenever that was right. And of course a lot of drinking that I started experiencing. And then, I started getting in trouble. I started getting sent away to, different types of juvenile institutions because of my behavior. And as a result of that, I would be in these places and I would run away from those places and I would go back to the streets, to where I was comfortable, to what I knew. And growing up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Twin Cities area, at that time, there used to be a lot of bookstores, a lot of these adult bookstores going on. And that's where I would go to. And I would go there to entertain people to make money. And I could make money to continue to get high and when I could. And another thing that was difficult for me growing up, being Native, I'm light-skinned and I have light eyes. So growing up on a reservation with Native people, there were times when I would be made fun of because I had light skin and I had light eyes. And it was no fault of my own. It was just the way it is. And that became real shameful for me, real, because I couldn't identify with who I really was at that time. And so I was ashamed of that. I was ashamed of my sexuality. I was, you know, I was afraid of being home with my stepdad and the things that he would do to me. So being on the streets and running away, that's where I was always comfortable with, you know, and I learned how to manipulate. I learned how to be really good at what I did, you know, growing up and being sent away to different institutions until I got older. Settled down. I went back home. By the time, between the ages of probably 16 and 18, I got into using drugs a little bit more. A lot of speed, a lot of drinking. Again, I left home. Never really stayed home. When I turned 18, I ended up in prison. I ended up going to prison for the first time. And I ended up there for 7.5 years. And while I was in prison, I started learning about who I really was. You know, it was unfortunate that I had to learn it in there, but it was fortunate that I learned it. And I started learning about the drum. You know, there's a lot of Natives in prison at that time. And I started learning and being accepted, you know, no matter what I looked like, and learning about the pipe and learning about our culture and learning about our language. And that meant a lot to me, and it was kind of like I finally found where I belonged. You know, I finally fit in somewhere. Although it was in prison, you know, that's just where I started to learn my culture and identify with who I really, really am. And when I got out of prison, I kept walking that red road, something I really, really believed in, but then I would forget about that. I would forget about my spirituality and those things that I learned from a lot of people that taught me, and I would go back into the using again and my old ways, and I would get in trouble again. And so throughout that 7.5 years, I kept going back and forth out of prison because I kept walking away from that spirituality in my life, that spirituality that when I was walking that way, it made my life good. And when I would walk away from it, my life would go bad again. Things would go bad in my life. And I started getting a lot of, when I got out of prison in 1988, I got married and I had a son. And I really, really thought that having a son would change things in my life, make me better. And so I gave up drinking. I just told myself I'm never going to drink again. But I continued to smoke weed, you know, marijuana. I continued to do that because I just didn't ever think I could ever be okay without using something in my body. So having a son and a little boy, and I still did, you know, drugs here and there, and I found crack cocaine at that time. Back in 88, and that was probably, no, it was 89. It was probably the worst thing that I've ever experienced doing drugs was crack cocaine, because I literally lost my mind smoking that stuff, and I would smoke it and not worry about anything. I wouldn't care about my kids. I wouldn't care about my family. I didn't care about nothing. I stole. I robbed. I did a lot of bad things to get that high. That crack cocaine was a really, really bad thing for me. And then I decided I was going to try something else. And me and a girlfriend of mine went out to California. We got out to California and we were in a stolen vehicle. And I was, we got arrested. They let us go. We came back to Minnesota and they got me on an auto theft charge to back out to California, because I was facing my California just started the three strikes law, and the three strikes law, you get 25 to life for your third felony, and that was my third felony. So they came back out to Minnesota, got me, brought me back out there, and I'm facing 25 to life. And I thought at that time, my life is over. That's it. I'm done. I'm never going to see my son again. I'm never going to see my family again. It was a pretty profound moment in my life where that was it. And being out there, everybody's from Minnesota. I didn't know nobody out there. And I got really lucky. I caught a break and they offered me 6 years with 80%. And then I ended up doing 5 years out there in California. But while I was out there, the same thing. You know, I found my people. I found my ways, the sweat lodge, and I started tending the sweat lodge. And I tended the sweat lodge every week out there for 5 years. And I quit doing everything in prison except for I smoked weed once in a while. But I started walking that red road again, and things were okay for me. I paroled out of California in 2000. I ended up coming back to Minnesota. I ended up finally going back home to my reservation, to my homeland, Red Lake Nation, where I'm from. And I finally told myself that I'm going to do things better in my life. You know, I got my son, and, you know, I went back to college. I went to college for a while, and it was unfortunate that I found crack cocaine again up in Red Lake. But what made it really bad at that time was that Red Lake is a closed reservation, so we didn't worry too much about the police. And so that's what made it worse for me, and I spiraled so bad into my addiction that I couldn't get out of it. It was just one of the most awful addictions that I remember having. And, I ended up getting rid of my house. I ended up leaving the reservation, and I went down to southern Minnesota, to Rochester, where my son is, where my son's family is, because I didn't think I was going to live that long. So I thought if I was closer to my son's family, if something happened to me, at least he would be with his family. And it was at that time, where being down there, I got into the drugs again. I just couldn't get out of it. My life went really, really bad. And I finally left Rochester, and I came up to Mille Lacs Lake, where my mom was, in central Minnesota. And I told my mom I got to come home. I haven't been home since I was like 16 years old. And I told my mom I need to come home, otherwise you're going to bury me. I was just like at the end of my road there. And I came home for a while and got my shit together and got a little job. And I went back to smoking the weed again. You know, I thought that was something that would keep me stable, keep me okay. And I hadn't drank. You know, it was in 2000. I had stopped drinking on April 8th of 1988. But I was doing all this other stuff in between. And, you know, I started, I went on a cocaine binge one night. And I remember it was really, really bad after being off it for a long time. And I went to a friend's house and I asked her if she could give me some gas money to get back home. And she knows about my past and she knows what happened. And so she told me to come in her house. So I went in her house and she told me to, she gave me a needle and she had some meth. And she told me, shoot this stuff up. It's way better than the crack cocaine, you know? And so I did that and I thought, wow, you know, she gave me like $30 worth of meth. And I tried that intravenously and it lasted me for 2 days. I thought, well, okay, 2 days, $35, or one night, $700. So I thought, I'll just stick to meth. I'm in a little bit better control with it. Doesn't cost me as much. I'm going to do all right on this stuff. But, you know, I'm an addict, and I did everything to the extreme. I didn't do anything moderate. I always did everything. I had to do it all. And, The meth just took its toll on me really, really bad. And so I had stopped doing the meth, and I kept relapsing and kept stopped and I'd relapse, stop, relapse. And I kept doing that, you know, and every time I would relapse and go on that binge, I would come home and I would promise my family that I'm not going to do that again. You know, I would look them in the eyes and I would swear to them, I won't do this again. And I just remember they would always believe me, you know, they were okay, it's fine. And so some years later, on and off, I got a job with the Mille Lacs band, and I married, I ran into my high school sweetheart, and we got married. She's a member of the Mille Lacs band. And so we got married, and we bought a house, and some land, and, you know, I had everything I wanted at that age, you know, everything that I could possibly ever want. And it was good. Things were going good, except I kept relapsing all the time, you know. And I would tell my wife, you know, I won't do this no more. I promise you. And I kept doing it, you know, every so often, if it was 6 months, 4 months, maybe half a year, whatever, I kept doing that. And, it got to the point where one time I had found out that I had hepatitis C. And I thought that was the end of me. You know, I didn't understand what that was. And they explained it to me that I probably got it from a dirty needle. So there was a program that could help me, that they go through this treatment that would get, you know, take the viral load out of my body so it wouldn't kill me. And so I did this 6-month treatment program that they put you through. And it's a really crazy thing, because they had told me when I was going to do the treatment that 90% of the people that do this end up relapsing. And I told my doctor, I said, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be okay. I'm not going to. So I did the treatment, got through it. And, of course, a little short time later, I ended up relapsing. And I ended up relapsing so bad that I had quit my job and convinced my wife that we could make more money selling meth. And I had her convinced. And that's what I used to do when I would use with partners or whatever. I'd convince them that it was okay and we can do this. And that's how manipulative I was in my addiction. Well, that only lasted a little bit of time. And I went back to a job is on the line. Everything's on the line here at that time. And after taking the Hep C treatment, it created what they call a diverticulitis in my colon. And I had eaten some dope one night, and that dope had gone into my colon, and it settled in some of the diverticula, and it created an abscess inside of my body, inside of my colon, and it got really bad for me that I couldn't even go to the bathroom, and it was too deep for them to drain. And I explained to my doctor what I did, and they said, well, we're going to have to go in there, we're going to have to remove part of your colon. And I just thought, in the meantime, they had to let my colon settle down for a couple months, and they told me they would just give me all the pain meds that I could take. And that's what I did. And eventually I got addicted to these pain meds for 2 months, because I was taking them pretty heavy, their OxyContin. And so then after I had the surgery, went back to work, everything was okay again, and I kept having hernias from the surgery, and I kept getting more pills, and I had about 6 hernias, and I kept getting those pain pills, which to me was better than doing meth or doing whatever. So then eventually the pain pills went back to the meth, so I was on and off on the meth. And pain pills became harder and harder to get, and I discovered heroin. I thought heroin would be a little bit better. It's cheaper. It's better than trying to run around looking for pills. And so I'm doing meth, and I'm doing heroin at this time. And it got to the point where I just could not stop doing it. And, finally my wife had told me she's had enough. She told me, I've had enough of you and doing this drugs. And I told her, no, I promise I'll stop. And she was done. And she said, you need to go get help. And I've never been to treatment in my life, all my life. And so I went to my work. I went to my boss. Now, the Mille Lacs Band has a program. And a lot of companies have programs that if they have mandatory drug testing, and you test positive for drugs, you're allowed to correct that. If you test positive, you're allowed to go into treatment. They can't fire you for that. They give you an option, and I took that option. I voluntarily told them I had a problem. I can't stop doing what I'm doing. I need help. And so it was waiting around and going through the process at that time. This was 4 years ago. Going through that process, trying to get a Rule 25, and then trying to get a bed in treatment. And it worked. The process worked, and I waited for a bed to go into treatment. And prior to that, I was still really, really struggling with, using on and off. And I was just, I remember it was Thanksgiving of 2016. And my wife told me she didn't want me home for Thanksgiving. Go home to your mom. Your mom's going to have Thanksgiving, so go be with your family. And so I thought, okay, my son was going to be there. My son had just admitted to me that he had been using meth. And so what do you tell your son if you're an IV drug user? I can't lecture him. So I just told him, well, I just hope you don't make the choices that I make. And I remember that night. I went to my mom's. It was the night before Thanksgiving. I was at my mom's, and I was just really, really sick, and I needed something. I needed some meth, or I needed some heroin, and I was getting really sick from heroin withdrawals. And I told my mom, can you borrow me $40 so I can go buy some weed so I can calm down? And she said, okay, take your son with you, because she didn't trust me. So I did. I said, come on, let's go. So we took off, and he asked me where we're going, and I told him, I'm going to get dope. And he said, I knew you were. He goes, I get some too. Now, this is my son. And I told him, okay, that's fine. So I went, scored some crystal meth, and I came back to my mom's house. She went to bed, and I was getting ready to do this up, and something made me not want to do it. I don't know what it was. I was tired. I was just tired, and I didn't want to ruin her Thanksgiving by being all whacked out on dope. And so I decided I'm not going to do it. I gave it to my son. I went to bed. I remember getting up the next morning, the next day, and my mom's got the house all nice and ready for people to come over for Thanksgiving, and just a really festive thing going on in the house. And I started getting sick again, and I called my guy, and I said, hey, I need something by the end of the day. And he said, okay. And I sent him a text message. He wouldn't respond to me. And I started getting mad because I was thinking, I'm going to go get something, and I'll have it until after Thanksgiving, and then I'll go get high. But in my mind, I knew I was going to not do it, and I would end up doing it. So he wouldn't text me back, and I was getting kind of frustrated, and I remember shutting my phone off. And I remember shutting that off and sitting there, and I told my son, let's go bank your mom's or your grandma's house with snow, because it had just snowed prior to that, so we were going to bank the snow against the house. And I remember years ago, I was at an AA meeting for whatever reason. And I remember a lady talking, and she was talking about your moment of clarity, your moment, when your moment arrives, you're going to know. She told me, you'll know. She said, it's going to happen. It's just going to happen. You'll know. And I remember that. I always remember her telling me that. And so my son and I were going out to bank my mom's house, and I remember something hit me. I was going down the stairs, and my son was walking in front of me, and this feeling hit me that was real powerful. It was so powerful that I didn't know what was going on, and it kind of like just went through me, and this warmth came over me. And I remember I just kind of felt like I was free, like everything was real clear. And I remember looking at my son, and I remember he looked like a little boy. And I remember him when he was a little boy, and I just remember how powerful that was. And we got out to the garage, and I started talking to him, and I started telling him everything. I just started talking, and everything came out so right and so clear. And he looked at me, and he said, Dad, you need to talk to somebody about this. And I remember looking at him, and I said, Son, I am. I'm talking to you about this. And he thought I was crazy, and he left. And I remember standing out there in the yard, and I remember looking up, and the sky was clear, and this huge eagle flew over, and I was watching this eagle, and I thought, wow. And I told myself this, keep this real simple. I remember, I'll never forget saying that to myself, because I didn't want to get excited about it. I didn't want to think that. Because I didn't want to blow this. I knew something was changing inside of me. And I remember calling this guy that did my Rule 25. He told me I could stay in touch with him. And I called him. Of course, he didn't answer. And I remember going to a meeting that night after Thanksgiving dinner. There's a meeting at this church in town. And I remember going there, and I thought, it's not going to be open tonight, because it's always on Thursday nights. And I remember getting there and going to the basement, and I looked around, and I seen this little man sitting on a couch. And I thought, wow, there's somebody here. And he goes, yes. He told me, I have to be here, otherwise somebody could die. And I remember that just struck me as funny. And I sat with him, and I talked with him, and I kind of shared things with him. And I told him I was going to be going into treatment. I want to come back. And I gave him my number, and I waited for a bed for 3 days. I remember white knuckling it, just waiting for this bed and trying not to get frustrated or trying not to get mad. Of course, I was trying to find a reason to go high, of course, And I remember sitting at home. I didn't have my car or nothing. And I remember calling this guy who's my sponsor, and he told me about acceptance. And he told me that acceptance prayer word, you know, acceptance, acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. If I can't, if I can't accept that everything is the way it's supposed to be, then I can't stay sober. And I remember he told me that, and I couldn't believe that he memorized it. And he told me to read it in the big book. It's page 417 in the big book. And I went, got the big book, I read it, and it made sense to me, and I started reading that big book from the first page. And I kept reading that book every day until I got into treatment. And I remember reading that book, and I remember thinking, this book was written before my mother was born, and it's telling my story. And it was just like, it was so powerful. And I ended up going to treatment. And they got a bed. I drove down to treatment. I remember getting there. I remember how scared I was. I remember how uncertain I was. I remember I wanted to know when I was getting out. They wouldn't tell me. I was getting mad. And so when I'm in there, I remember before I went in there, I called a friend of mine, and I told him what I was doing. And he couldn't believe it. He's like, "You're going to treatment." He goes, "Bro," he told me, "listen, do whatever they tell you in there. Listen to them. Let the process work. Trust the process." And I told him, I will. He goes, "So if they tell you you need to scrub toilets with a toothbrush, you ask for a whole box of toothbrushes." And I said, "I will, bro. I'll do whatever they say." And I did. I went in there and I listened. I listened to everything. Went through this whole treatment thing. It was only 32 days. Now, you got to remember, I've been an addict for 45 years. It was 32 days of a high-intensity treatment program, which I was only allowed to do because of my work. And so I get out of treatment that morning. It was December 31st of 2016, right before New Year's Day. I remember getting out that morning. I got my phone, and the guy that admitted me was the same guy that was discharging me that morning. And I remember him telling me, "Listen, I'm going to give you some advice before you leave." He goes, "You were a model client in here." He goes, "You did really well. A lot of people liked you." He goes, "I'm going to give you some advice." And I thought, all right, cool. And he said, all he told me was go to a lot of meetings and get a sponsor. And I thought, that's it. And he goes, "That's all you need to do. Keep going to meetings." So I thought, okay, I'll keep going to meetings to get a sponsor. And so I got my vehicle. I called my wife, told her I was out. I called my mom. I called my sponsor. He didn't answer. I called my other sponsor. He didn't answer. And so I'm heading home, and I get a text message from my homegirl. This is how powerful my addiction was. This is how powerful it was. Homegirl sends me a message and says, "Oh, you're out." And I was like, "Yeah." And she said, "I have some really, really good dough." And I told her, "Are you sure?" And she's like, "Yeah, it's really, really good." And I'm thinking, okay, I'm down in the Twin Cities, and I have an hour and a half to drive home. I started struggling with myself at that moment. You know how you know, you're anticipating getting high, and then anxiety kicks in, and you start getting focused on that moment, and nothing stops you after that. And I kept doing the breathing exercises that I was taught in treatment, and all these things that I was trying to get myself out of that thought. And I thought, in my mind, this is my addict mind, I thought, okay, I can go do this one more time, and then I'll be okay. I'll get this out of my system. And I was heavily breathing. I was just having a really rough time with this. And I remember I started driving away from the cities, and I'm driving up north, and my sponsor calls back. And my sponsor tells me, I answer this, "Hey," and he says, "Hey, what are you doing? You're out." And I was like, "Yeah." And he goes, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm going to go get high." And he's like, "Well, I want to get high." And I was like, "Are you serious?" And he's like, "Yeah." And I was like, "Okay, can you get anything? Ted, can you get anything?" And he's like, I'm sure I can find something. And now, that's, you know, I was thinking, okay, it's going to be okay. I can get high with my sponsor. I was justifying all this stuff in my head. And, you know, and he asked me where I was, and I told him, and he said, can you meet me at this Perkins? And I was like, I'll meet you. I said, you sure you can get something? Then I don't have to drive all the way up north, you know, and drive all the way back. And he goes, yeah, just meet me at Perkins. So I get to Perkins, and he's there with these two other guys that they look like they probably could be dope dealers. I don't know. And I remember walking up to him. Well, on my way up there, though, let me back up a little bit. On my way there, I started thinking about those 49 men that I was in treatment with. And I started seeing their faces. And I remember laughing with them and crying with them and having a good time with them and how vulnerable we were together as men, you know, and the friendship that we created in those vulnerable times, which I think is so important for men to do in recovery, is to be vulnerable with each other, to form a good relationship with each other, a good friendship. And I started thinking about that, and that anxiety was wearing off. So by the time I got to Perkins, I remember seeing Paul, and I was looking at Paul, and I could see on his face, you know, and I looked at him, I walked up, and he's smiling, and he told me, let's go inside and let's have coffee and talk about getting high. And I couldn't believe it. I was just like, this is the best thing ever. And I remember later on, you know, in my recovery, I asked him one time, I was like, Paul, you know, this is a program of rigorous honesty. You know, why did you lie? Why did you lie about getting high? And he told me, he said, listen, he goes, you're a good guy. You know, he says, I couldn't believe you were getting out of treatment to go get high. And he said, listen, he had a brother that kept doing that, going to treatment, getting out, and just doing this over and over. And he got sick of it, didn't want to communicate with him anymore. And his brother had gotten out and wanted to get a hold of him, and he wouldn't talk to his brother. And his brother went bought some dope and went home, went in the bathroom, got high, and overdosed and died. And the little boy, his son, went in the bathroom and seen his dad and grabbed the needle and brought it to mom and said, here, daddy gave himself a shot, you know. And that was real powerful to hear that. And I thought, man, I was really, really grateful for that, because he's still my sponsor to this day. I have several mentors to this day. And it was nice to get out. But it was hard for me to go back to the community that I came from, because I knew where everybody was getting high and where all the dope was. And so I formed a good support group around me and got together with people that we would support each other. And it was really, really unfortunate for me, because when I, you know, during the time that I was being sober, my wife and I grew apart, and they say that happens sometimes, you know, because she doesn't do drugs or anything, and so we started growing apart, and eventually we started talking divorce, and eventually we got a divorce, and that was probably the worst time ever in my life that was the worst experience that I've ever had, was going through that divorce. It was almost as bad as death to me, because in death it's final, but in divorce it wasn't. We just went through a lot of legal stuff that we had to go through. I'm still trying to get some of my property back. It was bad, and I literally lost everything, but I lost it when I was clean. So it was different for me. It was had a different effect on me, because most people hit bottom and lose everything and go to treatment, and it was different for me. So it became more difficult, but it made my I filled those cracks that I had in my body, in my life, in my heart with sobriety. And a friend of mine started a group called Sober Squad in Minnesota, and it has grown into something not as awesome as Sober Indians, but it's pretty awesome. It's a sober sober support group. We have 10,000 members, and we're just doing good things in the community. And I still kept my job. I still have my job. I live with my 75-year-old mother, who I should be there and taking care of her. And I rescue dogs on the reservation. I've rescued 229 dogs as of yesterday, and I continue to do that. That's something that the service work that helps me. And I just got to say this to the people that have been listening. You know, my story was kind of really quick here, but there are years and years of being bad, in and out of institutions, in and out of prisons. I've been shot 2 times. I've been beat down. I've been stabbed. I had part of my colon taken out of my belly button. 13 and a half years I spent in prison, and just a bad IV drug user. And, you know, I overcame that, you know, in my life. It was finally at a time when I finally surrendered, when I finally said enough is enough. And I had to just surrender that will, because it just never worked for me. And I had to form a relationship with a higher power that helped me, that helps me today. And it took a long time. It took about a year for me to get that right. But now, today, I have a relationship with Creator that I don't let anything get between me and Creator. And I just walk in a good way and just be kind to people and just do the best I can. And I think I shared with you guys that people that know Pat McCoy, who started Sober Indians. Pat McCoy is just an awesome guy. I love Pat. He's been, like I said, he's been a mentor to me, and he's done good things in this community here in Mille Lacs. It was unfortunate that he had to go back home, but hey, you know, he's remembered here and he's thought of. And I'm just really, really grateful that he asked me to come on this program and share my experience, strength, and hope. And I hope that that's pretty much it. I'm walking the sober road. November 24th of this last year was my 4 years, so I'm a little over 4 years, and just keep doing it. And I tell people, keep going to meetings, get a good sponsor, work the steps, man, because it works. It really, really does. And if it's worked for a lot of people, like I said, 45 years of being an addict, it works. You know, you can do it. And if I can do it, anyone can do it. Anyone can. So anyways, yeah. So thanks. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Karen, do you have...
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wanted to thank you for coming on the show tonight, too. You covered everything. And I really didn't have any questions that I could think of. So... is there anybody else that you want to acknowledge while we're on air at the moment?
Yeah, I just want to just acknowledge, well, again, Pat and you, Karen, also for making this happen. I know we had a little bit of confusion about the time zone times and everything, but I want to acknowledge Pat. I love this guy, my friend Colin Cash, for being an awesome friend to me and for going through the things that we've gone through together. And again, I just want to tell everybody, the simplest thing to do is just go to meetings, get a good sponsor, and just work the steps the best you can. You're not going to be perfect. I am not perfect in my recovery. I make mistakes. I'm still restless, irritable, and discontent at times. I think naturally I'm going to always be like that. But I'm aware of it, and I take action when I do it. Because prayer works, you know, prayer works in your life, and it's good to pray, but also it's a program of action. Because, you know, I can pray that my dishes are going to get done, but they won't get done unless I get up and do them. So I just want everybody to know that I love you all. I appreciate you listening, and I hope you continue your support. Sober Indians is badass, and yeah, So with that, I will close.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you.
I really appreciate it. And we wish everybody a great evening. And with that, we will conclude tonight's show.
Okay, Karen. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for listening. I appreciate it. I really, really do. Thank you from Minnesota.
Have a good nap.
Have a good nap.
You too, Karen. Thanks.
Thank you.
Should I just go off then?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, Karen. Thanks.